And welcome back. 66 years ago today, the Democratic Party nominated Harry S. Truman to run for president. Not surprising, he'd already been president for 3 years. As vice president, he had succeeded Franklin Roosevelt upon his death in April of 1945, and by 1948, Truman had secured a prominent place in history. He had authorized the use of the atomic bomb, oversaw the end of wars in Europe and the Pacific, and initiated the Berlin Airlift and the Marshall Plan. In July of 1948, integrating the armed forces and Korea lay ahead. Truman's background was hardly privileged. He was a farmer, worked as a bank clerk, and ran a business that failed. He got into politics because he apparently couldn't find another job. But what gets a lot of attention was his relationship with Kansas City political boss Tom Pendergast. We're talking about that relationship today with Dr. William Worley, professor of history at Metropolitan Community College in Kansas City. Dr. Worley, nice to have you with us.
Nice to be with you.
Well, I think we have to establish for the uninitiated exactly who Tom Pendergast was.
Well, yes, the type of politician that Tom Pendergast was is sort of a lost art in 21st century America in certain ways, but he was a urban political boss, of which we had many across the country in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Very few quite as effective as Tom Pendergast. He was able, especially in the 1920s and 30s, after inheriting a strong political organization from his older brother Jim, he was able to take that to a position where, by the early 1930s, he not only controlled Kansas City and Jackson County politics, but also, for a period, the State House in Jefferson City.
Did he have any kind of a statewide reach beyond Jefferson City?
Well, for Tom, rather like Tip O'Neill, all politics was local. And so actually the extension to state politics was only to the extent that it would benefit him and his organization here in Kansas City and Jackson County, not the other way around. He really wasn't interested in broader political influence except as it helped to guarantee what he could do here.
Yeah, I know, and you've just indicated that political bosses were commonplace in the country about the time of his ascension here, but there is generally a kind of a pejorative context given to political bosses, quote-unquote. Is that justified?
Well, to some degree, in that there's certainly political bosses worked with the lubricant of money. It took money to hire people to work the precincts, to do the jobs that needed to be done to make the political machine work. And a political machine was very simple, actually. It was a machine because it could automatically, or seemingly from the outside, automatically deliver votes every election. And not only just a few votes, but deliver substantial majorities in the areas affected. So there is a... The means by which Pendergast was able to get this money largely came down to what we would today call protection schemes. He controlled the police department in Kansas City and had since the very beginning of the 20th century all the way until his downfall in 1939. And so regardless of what the upper echelons of the police department said, the rank and file took their marching orders largely from Pendergast, and that made it possible, especially during Prohibition, to make sure that people, paid their protection money and then were allowed to do business as they chose or saw fit. And Kansas City was a pretty wide-open town in the 1920s and 30s.
That's a man with a lot of power, the man you just described.
Indeed.
What did he get in return? Aside from the money, the financial considerations here, he helped people get elected and he helped people get jobs. What did he get in return for that?
Well, he seems to have, among other things, gotten a great deal of personal satisfaction. You mentioned about helping people get jobs. And, of course, in the 1930s with the Great Depression, that was a particularly important aspect of it. And when he was interviewed at varying times, in part, you would expect him to say this, but I think he said it actually with, a good deal of feeling. He was very proud of the fact that he helped people find work. He helped people to survive in very difficult circumstances. He was for the little guy. That was his perspective. And succeeded in that really remarkably well. There is what's called Pendergast prosperity in Kansas City, which meant that especially from about 1930 until, again, his downfall in 39, Kansas City did not feel the effects of the Great Depression quite as strongly as many other parts of the country.
What was his relationship with Harry Truman?
Well, it really, in a sense, is sort of a backdoor thing. The relationship began, actually, not through Tom Pendergast, but his older brother, Mike Pendergast, who, there were actually four Pendergast brothers in Kansas City. Jim, the oldest, had founded the organization. Second oldest brother, John, never got into politics. He was a bartender. and very happily so through his life. Mike Pendergast was a politician, never quite as able to provide leadership for many people in the way that Jim Pendergast or the youngest brother Tom was able to do. But Mike seems to have been one who, on a personal level, people had a great deal of loyalty to. And the connection began actually right after Harry Truman graduated from high school, and the family had to move into Kansas City because they basically lost all their property and income and independence at that time. And they happened to move on to Park Street and across the street from the Mike Pendergast family. And so Harry's father and Mike Pendergast became very good friends. And that really is the beginning of the connection, and that goes back to about 1900.
What was it about Harry Truman, do you think, that caught the eye of the Pendergasts?
Well, what happened is it revolves with Harry around World War One. That is the transformative experience for him. It also is what makes the connection with the Pendergasts, or I should say brings that back to the fore, because Jim Pendergast, the son of Mike, also was in charge of a battery in the same regiment as Harry Truman was. And they got acquainted, they respected each other highly, and formed a friendship that lasted, through the lives of both men in that respect. And it's in 1922 that Mike Pendergast and his son Jim come into the Truman and Jacobson haberdashery and ask Harry to run for the what was then called the Western Judge position of the Jackson County Administrative Court.
But Harry Truman was not a lawyer.
No, but this is the administrative court. Today we would call it county commission, or in Jackson County we have a county legislature. But in this particular case, what it amounts to is that this was the administrative aspect of Jackson County government in those days. So they were sort of the executive and legislative branch all combined.
Well, obviously, Truman won. I think he was on the bench for how many years? 8 years? 4 years? 8 years? I'm not clear.
He was elected to a two-year term in 1922. He was defeated running for re-election in 1924. And then in 1926 and again in 1930, he was elected as the presiding judge of the administrative court.
So
he served a total of 10 years.
With Pendergast's help, he was elected.
Oh, yes. Now, in the first election, 1922, it's probably Harry's army buddies, because he's running in the part of the county that doesn't include Kansas City. And Pendergast at that time did not have that much influence out in the county. So as a result, there is Pendergast money backing Truman in 1922, but the machine was not really terribly effective at turning out the votes then. By 1926, and again in 1930, the presiding judge position runs in both Kansas City and the rest of Jackson County. Therefore, the machine operated quite efficiently.
So Harry Truman is obviously beholden to the Pendergasts for his success on the bench.
As far as electoral success, that's exactly right.
Well, you know, how did that show itself, or did it? I mean, did he have to? Go ahead.
No, the way it worked in reality is that Truman gave Pendergast a fig leaf of legitimacy as far as government was concerned, because Truman had built up, beginning in his first two-year term and then consecutively after that, a reputation of being a straight shooter, being an honest leader. Now, he believed strongly in the spoil system, because that was the standard of the day, and that meant that you would, you know, put people who supported you into jobs working for the county, and especially the roads department and the areas such as that, because that was the biggest employer that the county government had. And certainly, Harry Truman put Pendergast supporters into those positions. So that's one of the ways that he was helpful to Pendergast. But the other way was that, in fact, he was a reasonably honest administrator in terms of letting contracts and such as that. So it looked to the outside world like, well, Pendergast is supporting a good guy here. And that was very helpful to Pendergast.
Was Harry Truman in any sense tainted by this relationship at any point during it?
Well, certainly in public viewpoint, especially the Republican public viewpoint, if you will, yes, he was. He was seen as a product of the machine, and from an electoral standpoint, that would be an accurate statement. From the standpoint of how he did business, that was, you know, something else again. And he did business, you know, or worked with Republicans at the county level through his years there. But make no mistake, Harry Truman was a decided Democrat.
Was he effective in the early years, both on the bench and ultimately as he went on to the Senate?
Seems to have been. The Jackson County politics is a weird and wonderful world, or was, I should say, at that time. There had been, you know, lots of different kinds of situations. One of the things that Harry Truman did in the 1920s and 30s was to pursue a kind of avocation that he had, which was he was an advocate of good roads, of building new roads, especially across the county, so that farmers could get their produce more quickly into markets and be more profitable in that respect. And this is something that he pursued. In the same year that he was elected the presiding judge, 1926, he became the national president of what was called the National Historic Trails Highway Association. And so he was promoting the building of highways all across the country, as well as the idea of improving roads in Jackson County. And by the end of his two terms in the presiding judge position, Jackson County had the reputation of having one of the best rural road systems, paved rural road systems in the country.
But as you say, all politics is local, and yet Harry Truman went on to win a Senate seat here in Missouri. Mm-hmm. What sort of assistance did Tom Pendergast give him in that effort?
Well, after two terms as the presiding judge at the administrative court, Harry knew that the tradition in the organization was that was time to step down, let somebody else do that. And so his choice, actually, to succeed that would have been to be the county collector, essentially the elected tax collector for Jackson County. But when he talked to Pendergast about this, Pendergast said, well, we've given that to somebody else. And then offered as an alternative, and this seems rather odd from our perspective, said, well, how would you like to run for the United States Senate instead?
Yeah.
And Harry decided, after a little consideration, yeah, that might work. Of course, then he had to run against two Democratic rivals in the primary in 1934, one of whom was from St. Louis, John Cochran, who was a particularly strong in St. Louis County, but had fairly strong support in the city as well. The other opponent was a man named Milligan, who was from Richmond, Missouri, which is just an outlying area from Kansas City, but he was considered the rural candidate in that three-way race. There's no question that in 1934, there was fraudulent voting done in Kansas City and Jackson County, and that's almost certainly what provided the winning margin for Harry Truman. So Just as a few years later with Lyndon Johnson in Texas, fraudulent voting can bring folks to the United States Senate, and they can go on from there to, we could say, greater things.
We only have limited time, but I want to offer an opportunity for our listeners to come into the conversation.
Absolutely.
If they'd like to find out more about this relationship, 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org, or if you prefer to send us a tweet, do so at STL on air. You know, no one can deny Harry Truman's place in history, but I do think a lot of people must have been wondering back in the early 30s, where did this obscure politician from Missouri come from that he's now a member of the U.S. Senate?
Well, one of the things that happened when he first arrived at the Senate is somewhat telling. There's a tradition about giving the freshman or maiden speech on the floor of the Senate, and every new senator is supposed to do this after they've been there for a little while. And Harry Truman got up and gave his speech, which we have no real record of the content. But after he sat down, Huey Long, who was still at that point senator from Louisiana, stood up and very loudly proclaimed that he wanted to welcome the senator from Pendergast to the United States Senate. And as a result of that, in his first term, Harry was viewed with, I would have to say, a great deal of suspicion by many, including President Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, Huey Long was certainly one to talk, wasn't he?
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
Speaking of colorful politicians.
Absolutely, and reflective of just the kind of thing we're talking about. I mean, there were these bosses and cabals, if you will, political cabals, all over the country. I wonder if you see anything in Harry Truman's early days, and perhaps even through his association with Tom Pendergast, that might explain his ability to make some of the most difficult decisions a president has ever had to make.
Well, I think that his experience in terms of the political give and take in Kansas City and Jackson County did indeed prepare him for that. Harry Truman was an absolute realist when it came to politics. He knew that you had to build support. He knew that you had to build coalitions. You had to get support from groups that you sometimes might not altogether agree with, but they were important to the coalition that was the Democratic Party in those days and such. And that's one of the ways, for example, that he became exposed to the importance of the African-American vote in Kansas City. Pendergast worked with a sub-boss by the name of Casimir Welch in terms of influencing the black community in Kansas City to vote Pendergast's way. And Pendergast actually was getting large numbers of votes from the black community through his patronage activities. Even before Franklin Roosevelt ran in 1932, and by 1936 was getting a majority of the African-American vote across the country.
Was Roosevelt, did he object to Truman because of the Pendergast connection, or was it other things that came into play?
Primarily the Pendergast connection. Roosevelt was suspicious of folks who seemed to have a lot of background that way. It's interesting that he seems to have had more suspicion about people who were beneficiaries of boss support than he did folks from the South who were beneficiaries of segregationist efforts that kept the Democratic Party quite white, if you will, in the South. Tells you a little bit about Franklin Roosevelt there as well.
Well, Roosevelt came from New York State, and I'm sure he was familiar with Tammany Hall in New York City, which was pretty active at about this same time. So why did Franklin Roosevelt decide to pick Harry Truman as his vice president?
Well, it's a somewhat lengthy story, but to make it very short, what it boiled down to is there were two people who wanted to be vice president very much in 1944. One of them was the sitting vice president, Henry Wallace. The other was the fellow who had been a senator from South Carolina and then appointed by Roosevelt to the United States Supreme Court, and then resigning from that had become a White House advisor to Roosevelt. This is Jimmy Burns from South Carolina, a former segregationist governor of that state. What it amounted to is the two of them tended to cancel each other out in the national councils of the Democratic Party. The northern wing of the party did not want to have anything to do with the segregationist Burns. The southern wing of the party didn't want to have anything to do with what they saw as sort of a left-leaning Henry Wallace. And so Harry Truman continually is suggested by Democratic National Chairman Bob Hannigan of St. Louis as a possible compromise candidate, and ultimately that's exactly what happened. Roosevelt seemingly didn't care, although we do know that on different occasions he promised both Wallace and Burns that he would support them for vice president, and he only offered a kind of backhanded invitation right at the convention by telephone call to Harry Truman. So it's a very odd kind of arrangement. We could say that Harry was the least common denominator selection to be vice president in 1944.
Did the two men like each other?
Harry had a great deal of respect for Roosevelt. He also would get frustrated with him because Roosevelt would tell what the person he was talking to wanted to hear, along the lines of what I was just saying, with regard to Burns and Wallace. And then behind their backs, he would do something different. That was somewhat frustrating to Truman. Truman was very much more of the school that if you say you're going to do something, then do it and go forward with it. And that was the way he viewed Pendergast, by the way. He saw Pendergast as someone, if he gave his word, that was the way it was going to be. He also pointed out that Pendergast didn't give his word very often, which is also true.
At about the time that all of this was going on, roughly about the same time, Tom Pendergast was finding himself in difficulty with the feds.
Yes, this began in 1939. There had been a lot of investigations in Kansas City from 1936 to 39 as far as voting irregularities and this sort of thing. But it is interesting that ultimately what brought Pendergast down had nothing directly to do with that. It was, in fact, that they could establish that he had taken a payment of roughly $250,000 from the insurance companies of Missouri, who wanted favorable treatment by the insurance commissioner of the state, who happened to be a former business partner of Tom Pendergast.
And he did some time.
He did. He pled guilty to those charges. He spent a year at Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary. He'd been sentenced to 15 months, because remember, this is for income tax evasion. It's not for criminal activity otherwise. And he was released after a year for good behavior, basically, and also he was ill. He'd had a series of heart attacks while in prison. He lived another 4 years. Tom Pendergast died literally days after Harry Truman was inaugurated as vice president.
Wow. How did Harry Truman distance himself from Pendergast during this time period? Or did he?
Well, the time he had to do that was 1940 in the reelection to the Senate. And one of the ways he did it is, instead of having his campaign headquarters in Kansas City, he moved them to Sedalia. If he sent out campaign materials or whatever, it was coming from a Sedalia address, not a Kansas City address, which would automatically kind of remind people of the connection. The other part of it was that in the 1940 election, again, in the primary, you had two opponents to Truman, both of whom were competing with each other on how much they had done to put Pendergast in prison. One was Governor Lloyd Stark. The other was Federal District Attorney Maurice Milligan, a brother of the opponent of Truman in 1934. And Maurice Milligan was actually the one who presided over the guilty plea of Pendergast, so he probably had a better stance on this. But what it amounted to was that it was actually St. Louis that was a key to delivering the slight plurality of votes for Truman. He only won by 8,000 votes in the Democratic primary that year out of several hundred thousand cast. And the margin of victory was much more out of St. Louis than it was Kansas City in that election.
We've got to stop it right there. It's a fascinating story. Thank you so much, Dr. William Worley, for telling us about it. He's professor of history at Metropolitan Community College in Kansas City. Thank you so much for being with us. Fascinating stuff.
My pleasure.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with author Martin Goldsmith of Alex's Wake. It's a book in part about the luxury liner SS St. Louis, a vessel which carried 900 Jewish refugees fleeing persecution from Nazi Germany. The St. Louis was turned away by Cuba, Canada, and the United States and forced to return to Europe. And we'll hear from Gene Kranz. He was the flight director of the Apollo and Gemini missions and oversaw the first landing on the moon that happened 45 years ago this weekend. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.